Welcome to Canada's most irreverent talk show. This is The Andrew Lawton Show, brought to you by True North.
Hello and welcome to you all. Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. That is an old, I wouldn't call it classic rock. It's a song by Emerson, Lake and Palmer that used to be on my old radio show, a part of my theme song. And when I moved the show over to True North, I was not able to get the rights to use the song. So we got generic royalty-free intro music A, but it's kind of grown on me. So hope you enjoy it as well. And if not, well, it's short and then I pump come on and I'm, I guess, more pleasant to the ears, less pleasant. Don't interrogate that point too much. But good to talk to you wherever in this lovely country or world you are tuning in from, whether you're listening or watching live or catching us on the podcast or perhaps reading a transcript, 973 years in the future. I hope the weather is lovely and that global warming hasn't destroyed you all. Gonna talk about a few of the big picture issues of the day in the program this afternoon. Gonna talk about wokeness and why there might actually be just a little bit of good news on the horizon. Perhaps Canadians are, and Canada is not as woke as you may think or fear. Also going to give the latest on Bill C-63. This is Justin Trudeau's latest assault on free speech, trying to curb what you can say and see online under the guise of online hate, of tackling online hate. My air quotes are always lopsided because I'm like trying to avoid punching the, now I've just punched the bottom of the mic. So anyway, we're having fun today. And what else do we have? Later on in the show, let's get to this right now. Because the Emergencies Act was one of the most dangerous pieces of legislation that Justin Trudeau has ever decided to cozy up to. It's a bill that was put in place to deal predominantly with the idea of war and strife and catastrophe. And Justin Trudeau decided to invoke the Emergencies Act when he had bouncy castles in his front yard. That was and not even literally his front yard, on the street near his office. That was what Justin Trudeau saw as being war, catastrophe, calamity, strife, unrest, and all of that. So it's been litigated now, both literally and figuratively, for quite some time, that the Emergencies Act was used by the government because it just did not like the truckers. It didn't like the people that were protesting vaccine mandates. It didn't like the people that were doing all of this stuff that was embarrassing the government and trying to hold them to account for the COVID era policies that I think very much caused divisions and strife in society, not the convoy. It was the policies that the convoy came in response to that were causing division. So the government looks at this, realizes its window is closing, says, okay, we're going to invoke the Emergencies Act. We're going to use this unprecedented piece of legislation, this unprecedented tool. We're going to conscript tow truck drivers. We're going to declare protests no-go zones. We're going to criminalize protests, basically. And we're also, to cap it all off, going to freeze the bank accounts of anyone that we think is giving support. It doesn't matter if they've been charged or convicted of anything. If we hand their name on a list to the banks are going to do our bidding and they are going to freeze those people's accounts. That was what happened. And I'm putting a glib 30-second summary on it, but we cannot overstate just how extreme and how severe these measures that the Liberals championed were and remain in history as. So you fast forward a little bit after, and the Public Order Emergency Commission convened. Justice Paul Rouleau was appointed as the commissioner, and he ultimately found, it was very narrow, but he ultimately found that the government had made a reasonable or justified decision. He looked at the evidence, he convened testimony, he had pages and pages, thousands of pages of evidence, ended up producing what I think was a 5,000-page report, but he ultimately sided with the government. Now, we'll get to in a moment why that isn't quite the win that Justin Trudeau has tried to convince people it is. But before I go there, I should point out that even with that, he listed several recommendations. I think it was about 56 recommendations total, 22 that were specifically pertaining to amendments that he thought, this is Commissioner Rouleau, the Emergencies Act warranted. And I want to play a small clip here of Justice Rouleau announcing his findings.
After careful reflection, I have concluded that the very high threshold required for the invocation of the Act was met. In particular, for reasons that I discuss in detail in the report, I have concluded that when the decision was made to invoke the act on February 14th, 2022, Cabinet had reasonable grounds to believe that there existed a national emergency arising from threats to the security of Canada that necessitated the taking of special temporary measures. I do not come to this conclusion easily, as I do not consider the factual basis for it to be overwhelming. Reasonable and informed people could reach a different conclusion than the one I have arrived at. I determined that the measures taken by the federal government were, for the most part, appropriate and effective and contributed to bringing a return to order without loss of life or serious injury to people or property. I also found, however, that in a number of respects, these measures were deficient. These included important aspects of the Emergency Economic Measures Order, such as the absence of any discretion related to the freezing of accounts or assets, and the failure to provide a clear way for individuals to have their assets unfrozen once they were no longer engaged in illegal conduct.
So that was a bit of the oversight. And I think the key point there is when he says, yes, I found that the government was justified. However, it was not overwhelming evidence. And moreover, he said another reasonable person could look at this and come up with their own conclusion. Now, I won't go through the whole 5,000-page report, which I'm ashamed to admit I have actually read most of. That's how little of a life I had that when this came out. It took me quite a while, and I kind of jumped back and forth as I was going to and from the more interesting parts. I'm not going to read all of the recommendations, but if you look at the recommendations that he made, a lot of it is about communication between different branches of law enforcement. A lot of it is making sure that there isn't this jurisdictional overlap, or conversely, that gaps are being created because of jurisdictional fights between the federal government and provincial governments and all of that. He's talked about the importance of beefing up police liaison teams, which ended up becoming quite a crucial part of the discussion and debate around law enforcement. But he's also mentioned in a number of points here some specific recommendations for the Emergencies Act. Now, the federal government is supposed to take that and issue a response. They're supposed to take this to heart. They don't need to give him everything he's asking for. They don't need to do it all, but they need to basically show that they're acknowledging it. Now, the government has been slow walking this. They've waited until the very last day, I believe, or the very last week of when they had to respond. And in doing so, they're kind of showing that this is an afterthought. They're showing that this is not really something about which they care all that much. And I think to understand that, you have to fast forward to the fact that the federal government had its rear end handed to it a few weeks back when the federal court ruled that the use of the Emergencies Act was unconstitutional. It did not meet the threshold. And more importantly, the things they used the Emergencies Act to do violated unjustifiably the constitutional rights of Canadians. Now, ever since that moment, my theory on this, and again, I could be wrong, to use the Commissioner Willow line, a reasonable person can come up with another conclusion, but my theory on this is that the federal government has kind of been embarrassed by this. They've actually, for the first time in the course of their handling of COVID and the convoy and the Emergencies Act, they've had to endorse, well, they've had to accept a bit of shame. When it's a shameless government normally, but in this case, they've had to really accept that. And in doing so, what is abundantly clear, is that they do not want to talk about the Emergencies Act anymore. They don't want to have a debate about amendments to it because they don't want their record to be front and center once again. Which brings us to this morning and Dominic LeBlanc, who is the president of the Treasury Board, saying that the government's not really going to amend the Emergencies Act at all. They're kind of going to leave it as is, at least for now. Take a look.
The Commission's final report found that the high threshold to invoke the Emergencies Act was met and the decision was appropriate. It also contained 56 recommendations to address gaps that were identified and proposed changes that should be made if the Act were ever to be invoked again. The government's response focuses on ongoing and next steps as they relate to each of those recommendations. February 2022 marked the first time that the Emergencies Act was invoked since it became law in 1988. The hindsight provided by the Commission's work, as well as the work undertaken by the Government of Canada and parliamentarians, offers us a critical outlook on potential changes that could be brought to the Emergencies Act. As such, the Government of Canada will engage directly provinces and territories, Indigenous partners, stakeholders, and civil society on all 22 Emergencies Act-related recommendations, including seeking views on potential legislative amendments as described in those recommendations.
So he's saying, oh, yes, we're going to have some consultations. We're going to talk about it. We won't do anything unless we talk about it. We're going to have some more chit-chat. We'll talk to Indigenous groups. I don't know why you need to talk to Indigenous groups about the Emergencies Act. We're going to talk to other stakeholders. Didn't really specify who those were. I presume all people that will just rubber stamp what the government did. Will he talk to protesters? Will he talk to people in the Freedom Convoy? Will he talk to other people that the government might want to use the Emergencies Act to seize the civil liberties of? I'm not sure we didn't get that level of specificity from Dominic LeBlanc. Now, if you look at what the commissioner's report called for here, a lot of these things are very reasonable. One of them is they should eliminate from the Emergencies Act the section that refers to the CSIS Act definition of threats to the security of Canada. This ended up becoming really the linchpin of the government's argument, which was, what is the definition of a threat to the security of Canada? And the Emergencies Act outsources that definition to another piece of legislation, to the CSIS Act. And interestingly, it was the CSIS head who said, yeah, he didn't think that the threshold was met. So now the Emergencies Act is basically in the position that the government wants it in, which is there's a source of confusion around it, which the government can kind of leverage for its own political gain. Commissioner also called for a review to ensure that the definition of a public order emergency is exactly what it should be and what it needs to be. What else did he recommend here? That there should be a consultation requirement with the territories, not just the province. So that's more of a technicality. This one I find is quite interesting. The federal government should engage in discussions with Indigenous communities to establish the appropriate parameters for consultations regarding possible recourse to the Act. So they're trying to put in this race-based litmus test to how the Act and how consultations are dealt with. That is, the government's only going to screw up. They never do anything on the Indigenous file particularly well. That's certainly been true of this Liberal government, as a great many Indigenous advocates and activists have said. And they also say that the provinces and feds need to mitigate infringement on provincial jurisdiction. Well, mitigate is a bit of a weird one, because you had all the provinces but Ontario saying, we didn't ask for this act. Why are you doing this act that basically lets you storm into our province and our provincial jurisdiction? So all of these questions, and more, by the way, I just read a sampling, are questions that the commissioner put to the government that said, okay, yes, I'm siding with you in part, but here are all these things that you've got to deal with. And the federal government has now just said, we're taking our marbles and going home. We liked that you said we won. We wanted you to just end it there. We didn't really want all these recommendations. We don't want to deal with those. When the federal court came and smacked down the federal government by saying it was unconstitutional, the government just completely lost all interest in dealing with the Emergencies Act. The government turned around and basically said, all right, yeah, we're kind of done with this now. We only liked this when it looked like it was a win for us, but now that people are starting to turn on that, we want you to pretend it never happened. So this is the Liberals in denial through and through. It's the Liberals not wanting to deal with what will become, maybe not in the next election, but certainly in the history books, one of the most profound failings of the Justin Trudeau government, because this was literally invoking the closest Canadian legal equivalent of martial law. I realize it wasn't military control, which is why I'm couching my language there. The closest Canadian equivalent to martial law, and invoking that to deal with, again, bouncy castles and horns. And the horns weren't even that bad near the end of the protest, as police officials attested to in their testimony before the Public Order Emergency Commission. But everything else, it's the government was just embarrassed. And humiliation on a grand national scale is not, I guarantee you, a national emergency, not in any interpretation of the law. But again, the assaults on civil liberties do not end with Justin Trudeau's invocation of the Emergencies Act. Bill C-63, the so-called Online Harms Act, is the government's very direct way of reining in what it says is hate speech. And again, every time I talk about this issue, I have to put this caveat in. Hate speech is something that has a very specific meaning. It has a very specific definition. Hate speech is not just speech you don't like, except a lot of these measures are applied to that. This is what we see in social media speech codes from platforms like, not as much Twitter anymore, but historically platforms like Twitter and Facebook. So hate speech is supposed to be something that has a very significant, very strict meaning. But the government is muddying that. And they're using the apparatus of the state. They're using the Canadian Human Rights Commission under Bill C-63 to go after it. The result is going to be online discourse, which is throttled and managed by the Liberal government in this malign alliance between big tech platforms who are forced to basically uphold the government's so-called hate speech edict. So I want to talk about this, as I've said, continuously. I want to hit this issue from all angles because this is, for me, the big battle here. This is the hill to die on. Free speech, it always has been. John Carpe is the president of the Justice Center for Constitutional Freedoms. And just as a matter of disclosure, I will remind you that I am on the board of the JCCF, but this is not, for your sake, John, a performance evaluation by any stretch. Always good to talk to you. Thanks for coming on today.
Hey, glad to be with you, Andrew.
So you and I have spoken in the past about this. And I mean, the government has done us the courtesy of being very transparent about what it wants to do for quite some time. And we've seen in the course of the last couple of years that this trio of internet regulations from Bill C-11, which puts a podcast registry and brings the regulatory control of the CRTC to government and or to the internet. And then you have C-18, which throttles online news. And now you've got this finishing move on online discourse here. And let me just ask first and foremost, when the government comes out and says, we are duty bound to protect the charter, does that pacify your concerns?
Oh, no. Governments always claim to be, pretend to be, in favor of charter rights and freedoms. It's almost unheard of that a politician's going to upfront say, "Oh yeah, we're violating your charter freedom of expression." No. They insist that this is not going to have any adverse impact on free speech, and that's outrageous to assert that. That's false. We're going to have new powers given to the Canadian Human Rights Commission. We're going to have regulations passed by Prime Minister Trudeau and his cabinet colleagues, censorship regulations without input from Parliament, enforced by the Online Digital Safety Commission. We've got, preemptive punishment for people where a judge can order you to wear an ankle bracelet and be under house arrest because you might commit a speech crime. It is just to suggest that this is, has no impact on free expression is just ridiculous. It's outrageous to assert that.
I wanted to ask you about that thought crime aspect, because I remember when that Tom Cruise movie some years back, Minority Report, came out. It was literally a dystopian thriller. The premise of the movie was that police could see the future and they'd go around arresting people for crimes they were about to commit. And in this particular case, you literally have government taking the thing that was like the conspiracy theorist warning about what this dystopian futuristic government could do and enshrining it in legislation.
Well, if the Online Harms Bill passes in its current form, and the Justice Center is actively mobilizing to stop that, we've already had over 26,000 people sign our online petition. I hope to be delivering hard copies of that to Parliament in April. But if it passes in its current form, indeed, there's a provision there where you can go before a provincial court, a judge, you can say, well, I think, my next door neighbor, let's call him Mark Smith. Apologies to any Mark Smiths out there. I think Mark Smith is going to commit a speech crime. He's going to promote anti-Semitism, or he's going to advocate for genocide. I think he's going to do that. Mark Smith has to appear in court. Now, the judge does need a reasonable basis to that the fear is well-founded, that there's a reasonable basis for the fear. So it's not automatic. However, just the specter of that, that you could be hauled before a court where a judge, if a judge believes this complainant, that you might commit a speech crime, already the judge can say, okay, it's an ankle bracelet, house arrest. We're telling you there's certain people you cannot contact or communicate with. There's places where you can't go. You have to turn in your legally owned, legally acquired firearms. You can get all these conditions placed upon you without having committed any crime. That's in the bill if it passes in its current form.
When we talk about the speech aspect of this, one of the things that has changed between Section 13 in its original form, this is the provision of the Human Rights Act that was repealed by the previous Conservative government, the provision allowing the prosecution of online so-called hate speech, and now is that we have a bit more clarity from the Supreme Court of Canada on what hate speech is. And that came through a decision called the Watcott decision, which the government kind of copied and pasted in defining what hate speech is here. And I wanted to ask you, first off, if you could just explain, you're smirking. So why don't you just go with whatever's on your mind right now about this decision?
Well, the Supreme Court devoted no fewer than 4,000 words trying to explain what hate is. Outside of the criminal code context. So what does hate mean when human rights legislation bars hate speech? And it is the most meandering, muddled, confusing 4,000 words you could read. There is zero clarity. The reason I'm smiling is because it's hilarious in a way. I mean, it's also sad and twisted and sick, but it's hilarious that the government very proudly proclaims that they're going to bring laws into compliance with the great clarity that the Supreme Court provided in the Watcott decision. Look, if you can't say what hate is in less than 4,000 words, there's a reason for that. It's because hate is an emotion and it is subjective. You and I could hear or see the exact same, you know, listen to the same podcast, see the same YouTube video. You could say it's hateful. I could say, no, it's not. Or I could say it's hateful. You would say it's not. So the Supreme Court actually said that it is okay to ridicule and belittle and hurt the feelings of people and to promote dislike and disdain. However, do not cross the line into detestation and vilification. So you tell me, Andrew, what's the difference between detestation, which you cannot promote detestation, that's hate speech, but you can promote disdain, which is not hate speech.
Yeah, and I read this every time I talk about the issue, and I'll read it again because I think it underlines the absurdity you're describing here, John, which is that this is from the Online Harms Act. Hate speech means the content of a communication that expresses detestation or vilification of an individual or group of individuals on the basis of a prohibited ground of discrimination. For greater certainty, so we're supposed to be more certain at the end of this paragraph, the content of a communication does not express detestation or vilification solely because it expresses disdain or dislike, or it discredits, humiliates, hurts, or offends. So you can hurt, but you can't vilify. You can dislike, but you can't detest. You can disdain, but you can't vilify or detest. Like, this is going to come down to that old, I think it was Oliver Wendell Holmes on pornography in the U.S. Supreme Court. I know it when I see it, which is not exactly instilling a big dose of confidence in very rigorous, clear lines on free speech.
No, and the Canadian Human Rights Commission, if the bill passes, will once again have the power to prosecute Canadians, even based on anonymous complaints. So you could have like an atheist in Vancouver files a complaint against a Christian lady in Halifax over having made disparaging remarks about a mosque in Toronto. Okay. And that could be anonymous. And even if the members of that mosque are not offended by it, it doesn't matter. And then you get these unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats, most of them progressive, woke. They're going to look at your speech and decide whether it's hateful or not, regardless of whether anybody was damaged by it. You don't even need a victim. You could just have the Human Rights Commission bureaucrat prosecute you because she thinks that what you said is hateful. It will go before the tribunal. And if you are found guilty of violating the new regulations through the Online Harms Act, then penalties could be paying up to $50,000 to the federal government, plus on top of that, up to $20,000 paid to the victim of your hateful speech. $70,000 you could be out of pocket, and that doesn't even cover a penny of your legal bills. So that's a new reality that we're going to be into if this legislation passes.
I should point out, it was not Oliver Wendell Holmes. It was Justice Potter Stewart who used that line. So with all due apology to Potter Stewart for attributing his quote to someone else, but I think he had lifted it from like Arthur Conan Doyle or something. But anyway, I'll let me ask you about that fine, because you know, one of the things that strikes me from reading this is that you don't even really have to have suffered a loss or a harm to be eligible to be a victim and a complainant. Someone could make an inappropriate comment about some group that you're a member of. It wasn't applied to you individually, and you could be the one who found it and reported it and, you know, be the one who complains to the Human Rights Commission. And, you know, again, I don't want to be too, I don't even think it's a conspiracy at this point. I could see a bunch of people that check off all of these diversity boxes sitting on their computer all day and just mining Twitter to try to find something. And you could end up, you know, amassing like, you know, $2 million in the span of a few weeks of work, just trying to find these things that you can complain about. And again, that's not to say that the tribunal will go along with that, but it doesn't seem like the law itself would do anything to stop that, because there is nothing saying that you couldn't just weaponize the complaints process or just profit from it.
Well, that's what happened before when you have Mark Stein and Ezra Levant who were prosecuted under the Section 13 for, you know, Islamophobic or anti-Islam or whatever statements, whatever it was, but they were, you know, huge legal bills, and it's very stressful. The women that the Justice Center represented in British Columbia that were getting targeted by this person by the name of Yaniv, who identified as a woman and had the male body parts and wanted a Brazilian bikini wax, and would phone these women, many of them working out of their own home with children, and the women would say, well, sorry, we only provide this to women. And then Yaniv would file a human rights complaint. And it was hugely stressful for these women that you get this letter from the BC Human Rights Commission saying a complaint has been filed against you, legal proceedings have been commenced. And it's horrifically stressful. It's very time consuming. And if you don't have the Justice Center or another group that's providing a lawyer for you, it can be extremely expensive as well.
Yeah, and I guess as we look forward here, obviously this is going to go before committee testimony. I hope that you're called as a witness to testify. I don't think it will be Justin Trudeau that calls you up for your counsel or input on this, but you know, I hope they at least hear it. But what recourse is even available right now? Obviously, you've got a petition. It's really politicians that have to be the one at this stage to stand up against this, is it not?
Well, people should also contact senators. Senators are far less under the control of Prime Minister Trudeau than the Liberal Party members of Parliament. But people should contact their MP, regardless of what party affiliation, and particularly if your MP is a Liberal or a New Democrat, if they're hearing from a lot of constituents that there's opposition to this bill. They care about their re-election. They're nervous, and you could contribute to there being internal opposition. You know, the only thing necessary for evil to triumph is for good people to do nothing. So let's not do nothing. Let's phone and email our MPs, and let's you know, sign petitions. Let's spread the word to our neighbors, and let's exercise our responsibilities as citizens in a democracy.
John Carpe, Justice Center for Constitutional Freedoms. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you, Andrew.
All right. Well, let's take a bit of a turn to the bigger picture here. With laws like this getting onto the books in Canada, it's easy to take a rather pessimistic view at the state of things. And I warn you that I oftentimes am guilty of being the source of pessimism. I try to be smiling about it, but then I read what I've said and I'm like, oh man, we really, as a country, went down that road, didn't we? But there is a little bit of a reason to be optimistic, and that is that spending time talking to real people, as I try to do as much as possible, real people will often give you more confidence in the country than reading headlines will. And it was interesting. This jumped up on my radar the other day. Eric Kaufman, who's been on the show a couple of times in the past. He's a Canadian, but he's living in the UK, and he's a professor at the University of Buckingham, did a piece that was quite fascinating with the McDonald Laurier Institute that found, there you see it right there, the politics of culture wars in contemporary Canada. It found that Canadians are actually not as woke as you might be led to believe by many of those in positions of power in the media and in the political elites. I wanted to bring on Eric to talk about that a bit further. Good to talk to you again, Eric. Thanks for coming back on the show today.
It's good to be here, Andrew. Excuse me, I've got a slight cold, but hopefully not.
That's quite all right. Hopefully we won't strain you too much in the next few minutes here. You and I spoke about your desire to bring a bit of an academic focus to wokeness in the past. So it was interesting for this to come up here. What did you set out to question first off?
Well, yeah, this was, I'd done surveys on the culture war opinion in the US and Britain in 2021 and 2022. I was just interested in, as a Canadian, to see what the Canadian public opinion looks like in relation to Britain and the US. Clearly, in public policy terms, Canada has charted the kind of most what you might call woke or cultural socialist path compared to the other countries. And so I was wondering if we could pick up that trace in public opinion. And what really surprised me was that the Canadian public was basically a carbon copy of the British and American publics. There was really no consistent difference in their level of support for the woke position on whether that be gender ideology, critical race, and history. It seems like there's no real difference.
What I find fascinating about that is that the institutional approach to these issues is vastly different in these countries. I mean, you live in the United Kingdom. I follow UK news quite a bit. You have issues of police departments that are knocking on your door if you tweet the wrong pronoun there. And you have this non-crime hate incident thing that is incredibly chilling. Whereas in the US, you have kind of the opposite, which is, sure, you've got infiltration of school boards, but you've got strong First Amendment protections. You've got a very strong culture of debate and discussion. Canada is probably somewhere in between. So how does that happen? Where on one hand, you have just these institutions in these three countries that have wildly different approaches to these issues, but the people are the same in all three.
Well, I mean, I would say that I think in Canada, certainly on the gender issue, they were the latest to push back in the three societies, especially if you consider the red states. But certainly in Britain, on gender affirmation, there has been a very much more robust, you know, the CAS review. They closed down the Tavistock Clinic. Mm-hmm. So it's just been a lot more responsive to public opinion, and likewise on statues and history. And there's now a review of sex education in schools. In a way, we don't see that level of policy responsiveness in Canada. I mean, one of the things that jumped out in the data was that Canadians were more trusting of the media than, say, British people and Americans. And so one possible explanation is that the greater sort of trust and leeway given to political elites by Canadians allows them to depart from public opinion more than might be allowed in other countries.
Well, and I would also say in the UK, certainly, you have a much more diverse media landscape. I mean, the British tabloids are all the stuff of legend, but you also have, in general, I think, in the UK, there's much more of a presence in mainstream media for conservative opinions. You've got the Daily Mail, the Telegraph, and GB News, and Talk TV and all of these. Whereas in Canada, the independent media landscape has been a more recent, it's a bit more nascent, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean, you're right about that. I mean, I think there are some, you notice in Britain, the politicians, the conservative politicians are quite timid on cultural issues and have been more focused on just that liberal conservative, fiscal conservatism. But I think have felt pressure more from the press, perhaps. You're right. I mean, they've still been reluctant to move on a lot of these things, but not as reluctant as the Canadian conservatives. Now, of course, Canadian conservatives, we're starting to see some movement, starting in New Brunswick with Premier Higgs, but now Poilievre has said some things. What we haven't seen, however, is any challenging of the critical race and historical narrative. So for whether that be the residential schools, the genocide narrative, and that approach to Canadian history, whereas in Britain, in France, in the US, that's been much more robustly challenged. And again, what the survey data shows is Canadian, 2-1, they're against removal of statues of Sir John A. Macdonald. 70-30, they say Canada's not a racist country. I mean, more than Americans and Brits, Canadians are reluctant to say their country is racist. That just isn't being reflected at provincial or federal level, even if the gender debate is starting to happen a little more.
Yeah, and I was going to ask, because obviously the relative value of Canada compared to the US and UK is interesting, but I'm also fascinated by the absolute values in just Canada alone. And it is a clear majority that on all of these different questions, and I was wondering if you could just give a few more examples of which questions you've probed here, but Canadians are overwhelmingly, if you can distill the binary into the woke option and the non-woke option, it's the non-woke option winning every time, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, not 100% of the time, but on average, it's 2-1 against the woke option in public opinion. That's a good rule to use. Now, there are certain questions. Should kids be separated by race and school into oppressors and oppressed? 92-8 against. Should school children be taught there is no such thing as biological sex, only gender? It's like 85-15 again, you know, massive. Or
which is quite massive. To jump in on that, Eric, if you put that poll question to your average teacher, I think you're going to see a huge mismatch there.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I don't think a lot of Canadians realize just how much these, particularly the radical end of things, is running against public opinion. I mean, by a 70-30 margin for Canadians to say they don't want teachers telling kids that Canada's a racist country, you know, that's a pretty massive opposition to a policy which is kind of running through a lot of schools, like the removal of Sir John A. Macdonald. Again, public policy, the elite institutions are completely out of phase with public opinion. And I think that really offers a lot of opportunities for the braver of the Canadian politicians.
So just to circle back to the trans issue, and you mentioned that the timidness of Canadians, and I'd say Canadian conservatives, this is one interesting one because the UK Tories, I would say, have never been a particularly culture warrior party. But in the last couple of years, you've seen some movement on this issue. And I think there are probably some domestic political realities there that aren't necessarily of interest to delve into for people. But I think, you know, J.K. Rowling, I wonder if she plays a role in this in a lot of ways, because I think she has really given in Britain, and I'd say around the world, a face to the, you know, the right wing position, despite not actually fitting the mold of what people expect the right wing Haiti hate monger to be.
Yeah, I mean, you have a sort of vocal left wing, often lesbian, gender critical feminist group. And, you know, it's interesting to watch because in The Guardian, they've been frozen out, which is the left wing newspaper. But they have found a voice even to some degree in The Independent, which is also somewhat left. And so there is a kind of left wing gender critical voice, which has been important, I would say, in Britain. Rowling symbolizes that as well. My sense in Canada, that's there, but they don't seem to have the public profile and they don't seem to be moving the debate as much as they have in Britain. So yeah, I think on that question, you definitely see the prominence of, you know, Britain, this joke about Turf Island, you know, and I think the turfs, if you like, have had actually an impact in that particular policy area. It's quite noticeable. And I don't know whether that's going to happen in Canada or not.
Now, I mean, obviously you're a scientist, so you don't necessarily like the prediction game, but I'm curious, if you were to just redo your UK and US surveys, do you think you'd see some movement and which direction would that be going? And conversely, if you did the same in Canada, say in 2 years.
We might see some movement. I mean, there's been quite a bit of survey work on attitudes on the sort of trans issue, where just in the last 3 years, we've seen about a 20-point shift away from the woke position in Britain and the US. And in a way, given that a lot of attitudes have kind of, if you think about gay marriage or interracial marriage, they've been getting more and more progressive over time. This really sort of stands out. The British Social Attitudes Survey, I think, was the most recent one. And so it does appear like attitudes on these questions are moving in the opposite direction that progressives would like, at least in the US and UK. I suspect in Canada something similar is occurring. But again, it just goes to show that the momentum is moving away from the trans activist position. Now, how do the conservatives in Canada handle that? You know, clearly they're doing very well in the polls. They probably don't want to rock the boat. But on the other hand, they have to be at least somewhat aware of what their grassroots are saying. And unlike an issue like abortion, for example, these issues are, you know, 2-1 in the population. So there's very little risk to go after them, I would say.
Now, I mentioned at the beginning, you and I spoke on this show when you had launched this class you were going to do on wokeness. And I just wanted to get a bit of an update on that now that we're a couple of months into the term.
Well, the course on woke is well underway, and you know, people can definitely sign up. Go to my Twitter and look at the pinned tweet. Yeah, we've got probably 400 or 500 expressed interests, and the classes are the seminar options. I mean, they're some of the most fun I've had. No need to call on any students. Everybody's got an opinion. So yeah, I think it's been a big success, and I think it just shows there's kind of a pent up demand. And people are coming at this. I just did a little bit of a survey, you know, because I'm such a survey wonk, but it seems like the class splits roughly between left and right, you know, in terms of their ideological affiliations. Some are more interested in the gender side. Some are more interested in the critical race side. But yeah, I think it's been very interesting. And it just strikes me, the outpouring of books on this. I mean, it seems like every week there's another book. I've got one in May. So I mean, it's a crowded field, but somebody has to sort of make sense of it all.
And that would be Taboo, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The book is Taboo, How Making Race Sacred Produced a Cultural Revolution. So that is coming out in May. We look forward to that. We'll have to have you back on then.
Thanks, Andrew. Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you, Professor Eric Kaufman. Always a pleasure. We will wrap things up there, back tomorrow to close out the week of The Andrew Lawton Show. But as always, don't forget, Off the Record on Fridays. I'll be back in the saddle this week. In the saddle? How are you in a saddle? I've never actually questioned that term before, because you should be on the saddle. I mean, the horse is in the saddle, but that's not... Anyway, try not to picture it too much. I'm already regretting it. All right. We'll be back tomorrow. This is Canada's most irreverent talk show. Thank you. God bless. And good day to you all.
Thanks for listening to The Andrew Lawton Show. Support the program by donating to True North at www.tnc.news.